I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Robert Putnam, came up with a diagnosis of American society about 5 years ago that quickly became a bumper sticker and then an argument. The article became the book. Now, it's called Bowling Alone, embodying the theory that, yes, Americans still bowl, but they bowl by themselves, not in leagues where they used to share their lives over a beer when the bowling was over. The idea is that the dense social fabric of connections and clubs that make for a vital civic community in America, the whole thing is falling apart, he says. It was the Frenchman de Tocqueville's view almost two centuries ago that part of our special quality in this country was that, as he said, Americans of all ages, all stations in life, all types of dispositions are forever forming associations, not only commercial and industrial associations, but others of a thousand different types, religious, moral, serious, futile, very general and very limited, immensely large and very minute. That was de Tocqueville before the Civil War. Today, the question, and maybe the argument is, was Robert Putnam's diagnosis the right one? Are the declining ranks of Elks and Rotarians in America a symptom of general civic malaise, or are they just yesterday's network of what are today soccer moms, or online chatters, or gay choruses, or the bonded startup teams that are forming internet companies these days? Connection listeners, are you connected? Are you interconnected? Do you volunteer? Do you join? Do you participate? How do you observe the health of your own community? And have you got a new club or cluster for the old ones that have died? The phone's 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK to make the bowling alone connection with the man who coined the phrase, Robert Putnam. Welcome, Robert Putnam. You've taken this idea back to the shed and hammered it all manner of ways under some pressure of criticism. What's the revised bowling alone theory?
Oh, the theory hasn't revised at all, Christopher. It's true that people raised a lot of questions, the questions that you have just now recited about maybe I'd lost track of important rising forms of connectedness. And frankly, after I originally wrote the article, I thought maybe that was true. Maybe I had missed some forms of organizations, or maybe wasn't organizations at all that was replacing these dying organizations, but maybe people were just schmoozing more, hanging out in bars or going on picnics more, working together, hanging out after work together more. And so it wasn't so much that I took the theory back to the shed, but I did actually work hard to see what the evidence I could find, pro and con, the original theory 5 years ago. And I now think, having gathered actually a lot more evidence, hundreds of times more evidence than I had originally, that the original article, Bowling Alone, was wrong, only in that it understated the breadth and depth of the changes. I think when you take into account the things that are rising and the things that are falling, the net is sadly down. I say that wanting to be careful that I don't sound like I'm being critical by any means of soccer moms or gay choruses, both of which are perfectly fine examples of new forms of social connection that I welcome and laud. But in the business of making assessments of social change, you have to look both at what's going up and what's going down and try to make some kind of net.
Inventory the down. And as much as you can, sort of give us a notion of the reason.
Well, those are two separate questions, of course. The inventory of the down is not only the kinds of organizations that you cited in your intro, that is, the Elks Club and the League of Women Voters.
Civil War veterans.
Civil War veterans actually wasn't on my list, no. Christopher. Veterans were on my list, but there are a lot of veterans from the Korean War still alive who are, and from the Vietnam War, that actually are not members of veterans organizations in the way that their predecessors were. No, it's not even just associations. That's actually the thing that I discovered when we stumbled onto these massive new archives of data, in all sorts of informal ways. It's not just organizations that are declining. Americans don't have friends over to the house nearly as much as we did 25 years ago. There's been a decline of about a third. There's been a decline of about a third in the frequency with which we have dinner with our own family. There's been a decline of about a third in the frequency with which parents take their kids on vacations as a family vacation. We're taking more vacations, but we're not taking them as a family. There's been a decline of about a third in the frequency with which parents watch TV with their kids. It's not that kids are not watching TV. Actually, they're watching more TV than ever, but they're not watching it. They're not watching it with adults. There's been a decline of, as you know, because I know you've read the book carefully, there's been a decline of about 60% of the frequency of picnics. And there's been a decline of people going out to bars. So Cheers is a period piece. It's not an accurate account of, there's no evidence at all that there's any growth in people schmoozing at work, for example. There's been a decline of about 40 or 50% in the frequency with which people play musical instruments.
Say that again, 40, 50%?
In the frequency with which people play musical instruments. Playing a musical instrument used to be a kind of a way in which either just in a small group, a chamber orchestra, or playing in a band. My wife actually is a member of the Lexington Town Band, and I met my wife in a college band, but that's now actually very old-fashioned. People don't play instruments. There's, as I say, the evidence shows there's been a significant decline in that. There's been a decline in the aggregate in people singing in choruses. I know you're a member of a gospel chorus, and as you say, there's been growth in gay choruses, but net, people are singing less together. So it's not just the old-fashioned funny hat organizations that you cited in your introduction. It's all forms.
What is your theory that people are doing with all that time? Or are they simply sitting catatonically in a corner?
No, part of it is, of course, we're working. Some of us are working harder than people like us used to. That's part of the story, and that's especially true for true career families. If we have time in this hour to talk about possible solutions, I think that one of the most important kinds of solutions that we need to think about is dramatic increases in workplace flexibility, work time flexibility, and so on. That's part of it. I hate being a cultural grouch. I don't like it at all. But the fact of the matter is what the surveys of how people spend their time say is that there's been a pretty substantial growth in the amount of time people spend watching TV, and mostly watching TV alone. That's not the theory I started off with when I got into this business 5 years ago, but that's what the data show. Some of us are spending more time commuting, and that's another part of the story, as you know from reading the book. And this is, again, something that I didn't have any idea when I was first exploring this topic 5 years ago. Sprawl, urban sprawl doesn't appear in the little article that I wrote. But when you examine the evidence more closely, it's clear that every 10 minutes more of additional commuting time cuts all forms of social connection by 10%. 10 minutes more commuting time means 10% less church going, 10% fewer dinner parties, 10% fewer club memberships, 10% fewer going to fewer meetings. So urban sprawl, which we're in the midst of and you and I live with, is another part of the story. There are a lot of things we're doing with our time. We're just not connecting.
I don't want to picture you as a grouch. In fact, quite the opposite, because when people read Robert Putnam on this whole idea of social capital, it's enormously stimulating. Social capital being the free exchange in as complex a way as possible of social goods. We sing together, we plow together, we may commute together,
although we're commuting less together than we used to, but yes, that's a good example.
Yeah, but whatever we do, that we do it together makes it better. It's from Robert Putnam that we get this idea from his big survey of social activity in Italy. He found that the single best measure of a kind of social health was the density of volunteer, church or otherwise, singing groups. You have these wonderful maps of all the trickle-down benefits of high social interaction. People live longer. They don't cheat on their taxes as much. They report themselves to be happier. They have better public health. They're less pugnacious. There's less violent crime. All these kinds of benefits you point out come with intense social action. And that's not grouchy at all. My big question about the book is whether, in fact, this kind of social action has sort of crumbled and faded away, or simply changed into new modes that you haven't picked up on yet, which would be my general theory, that people have found are finding other ways in an electronic century, in a harder working century, to interact. I mean, I think the office place, there's a lot of corporate nonsense about it, but I think the office place in many places is a more interactive place. I think interactive radio, including this very program, has made a community where there wasn't one before. I think the emergence of gay groups, for example, that didn't have a chance to affiliate, it was not socially respectable to affiliate before in a chorus or any other kind of association. These are very vital places for a lot of Americans nowadays.
As I say, Chris, I certainly don't disagree that gay choruses are a good example of social capital, and there are more of them. But of course,
reading groups
are actually flat and not up. But there are a lot of people
who do
this. Well, says the surveys. It's not a matter of what I say; it's what the surveys say. People, we surveyed Americans in
We're
19...
going to survey Connection listeners today. I mean, I want to hear from.
All I'm trying to say, Chris, is that the best evidence, when you ask people in the 1970s how many of them went to reading groups, and you ask people in the 1990s how many of them go to reading groups, there's been no growth in reading groups.
I have no special brief for reading groups.
Reading groups are great. I would like to have more of them. It's not that I'm against them. I'm just saying. In this discussion about what the trends are like in reading groups or in workplace friendships, it's important to have some evidence. My only stock in trade, Christopher, is trying to see if I can find evidence and not just compare my personal anecdotes with your personal anecdotes.
Okay.
And you know, my wife is in a reading group, so for goodness sakes, I think reading groups are wonderful. That's not the question. The question is, what's the evidence, what's the hard evidence say about trends in all of these alleged counterexamples that you've been citing? For example, I looked really hard, and there's a whole chapter on this in the book, really hard to find evidence, pro or con, the claim that there's more people are spending more time at the office schmoozing. And there just simply isn't any evidence to support that theory. I'd love to know if you know some evidence, Chris.
It's not about schmoozing. It's about having interactive software where your job isn't done until I've seen it and commented on it, and mine isn't done until you've done your piece. My job in life is to engage the connection listeners and hear their evidence, but I put it to the listeners. What's your experience of feeling alienated, lonely, or connected, or affiliated on the job or off, and especially are there new institutions out there that make up for the attrition of the IBPOE or the Rotary Club?
Christopher, it's a little fair for you to add that much of the point of the book is to encourage new forms of connection. So I'm absolutely delighted to sort of compare notes and see whether the things that are rising are falling. I wouldn't want you to mislead the readers into thinking that the book is basically critical of new forms of connection.
No,
on the contrary,
I
laud them. I'm eager. Most of my time nowadays I spend as a missionary going around the country trying to encourage.
No, I understand that. But let me just say, as an example, the prevailing model, at least in conversation, of the new business organization is the internet startup formed by, three bright engineers and two marketing geniuses and four people who didn't know what to do with their lives, but suddenly they are on a rocket ship together, bonded as never before. They may be their own singing group. They may be they're by default their
sure.
own community group or book group, but they are plunged into this kind of deeply sharing sort of your work is your life, your work is your destiny kind of atmosphere. It's a real new phenomenon. Where do you chart that, for example?
Well, it is a form of social capital, a social connection. And as I say in the book, it certainly deserves to be put on the positive side of the ledger. It isn't quite the same thing as belonging to Rotary Club, actually, because the Rotary Club has a certain kind of course, part of what's going on in the Rotary Club is people making connections that are useful to them in professional terms. But the Rotary Club also has certain kinds of service activity, broader service activities to the broader community. My daughter got a fellowship from Rotary, for example. I don't belong to Rotary. Lots of people in America have gotten fellowships from Rotary. That's not the kind of thing that typically happens around the workplace. So what I'm trying to say is it certainly is real connections. the startup company. It no doubt does help the health of these kids that they're connected rather than not. It doesn't have all the same benefits of some of the older forms of connection. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing, Christopher, is we shouldn't get hung up thinking that 100% of people in America work for dot-com startups. Most of them don't.
And lots
of people work in circumstances that are much more anxiety-ridden today than was true a generation ago. The level of anxiety about the workplace, the level of fear that the guy working next to you will take your job next week because you're going to be downsized is much higher, demonstrably higher, than it was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. The level of sticking with one firm and sticking in one office is much lower than it was. And it's all the evidence is quite clear that if you change jobs frequently, you don't make as many friends as you do if you stay around longer. And we know that Americans are moving jobs more quickly. It may be good for the economy that we're more flexible and so on, but it isn't necessarily good for our friendships at work. So it's right to say that some forms of connection in the workplace, in some workplaces, are rising. That's great. It's also right to say that some workplaces are less friendly than they were a generation ago.
Robert Putnam is our guest, and his book with the famous title is Bowling Alone. It's a kind of caution about what could be the deterioration of a great American bonding principle. We are a nation of joiners, have been from the beginning. Are we still? 1-800-423-8255 makes the Bowling Alone connection with Robert Putnam. Mike is calling from Portsmouth, Rhode Island.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Really, great show, Chris, as usual. Mr. Putnam, very interesting to hear what you're saying. I just want to, I'm questioning, kind of taking issue with your statement about people not playing as much music as they used to. I'm not a researcher, but I'm involved pretty heavily in different kinds of music, mostly folk music, and I've noticed over the past 10 years what an incredible increase there is in the amount of people who are playing folk instruments and supporting different types of folk music. The ones I'm involved in are mostly bluegrass music and Irish music, and yet I see an increase in both those.
Well, that's terrific, Mike. As Christopher knows, I'm a longtime fan of musical groups, both singing and instrumental as forms of social connection, and I'm delighted to hear about the growth in, at least in your area, in bluegrass and folk music playing. I wish it were true nationwide. The evidence, overwhelmingly, of, for example, surveys done every year by the people who sell musical instruments or sheet music, by the people who gather evidence. I cite a very regular long-term survey of Americans that's asked them every year for the last 25 years, how many times last year did you play a musical instrument? There's been a decline of about 50% in the frequency of that. So I don't want to, I can't obviously deny your personal experience, and I think it's wonderful. I wish more Americans were connecting in music groups. I have to say that as I read the hard evidence, that's not typical.
Mike, do you want one more bite?
Well, it just fascinates me that my personal experience, which goes quite a ways, because I do belong to a number of organizations that these things participate in, bluegrass organizations and stuff, it seems to be a little contradictory to the speakers. That's about it.
Fair enough. Mike, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Terry is on the line.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
Hello, Terry.
Just a different spin, and I think maybe males have taken, picking up on the title, a strike on this. They've struck out. About 10 years ago, I watched my wife and other women get together, and they would bond, or whatever word you want to use. But in any event, they enjoyed themselves, and they didn't necessarily drink a lot, or they didn't do the, quote, female things. They just enjoyed themselves. So I had asked these men, about six or seven of them, all of whom were very professional, worked 50, 55 hours a week, why don't we get together, and why don't we just try to do that? And, you know, for God's sake, you don't ask your wife to make some food, and we come over to the house, and we ourselves just do something. Never worked out. We met once. They wanted to know what we were going to do. One guy's going through his daytimer, trying to figure out what the next event is. So my question is, and I'll take the answer off the air, is what do you think about this has to do with the idea of male and female, that the female isn't allowed? They almost seem like they felt guilty about taking this time to either relax or just to be together among men and talk about topics. And thank you very much. It's a nice topic.
Thank you. Terry, thank you.
Thank you very much, Terry. Well, you've hit on a whole nest of really interesting questions, Terry. There are And I talk about this a little bit in the book. There are, it appears, significant differences between men and women in America today in terms of how they connect. I have to say, it looks from the evidence that I've seen, is, and this of course fits most people's personal impressions, that women are just better at connecting with other folks. My favorite factoid from the data is that when two people get married, that cuts by 3/4 the number of greeting cards the man sends, and increases by 3 times the number of greeting cards the woman sends. So there is some, I think, differentiation by gender. I think that the trend of women moving into the labor force, which is a wonderful trend. I'm delighted that that women have opportunities that they didn't have a half century ago to be involved in professional life. That trend toward two-career families has had a fundamental effect on the way not only our communities fit together, but the way our families fit together. And we have not yet begun as a society to think through the implications of that for the requirements for more flexibility in work life. It seems to me that let me put it this way. Between 1865 and 1900, during the Industrial Revolution, a third of Americans changed their workplace. They moved from fields to factories. And then it took us about 20 years to work out the details about what that means for work rules. When we were still working in fields, people thought it was fine for kids to be working. That meant Susie picking beans in the back 40. But after we were mostly working in factories, it wasn't so fine that kids were working, because that meant Susie working in a sweatshop. So we did work out the changes in our labor law and labor customs that adapted our work life to fit our family and our community obligations. We have not been through anything like that same adjustment of our labor laws and labor regulations and labor practices. And so I think that not only because of the need to allow people more time to connect with their community, but also with the need to spend more time with their families, I think we've got to be really think quite ambitiously about how to use some of the new technologies to make it possible for people to have much, much more flexible work days, work weeks, work careers.
Give us 5 suggestions to get us started.
Well, for example, my daughter-in-law is a great lawyer. She graduated from the law school at Columbia and was on the Law Review. My son decided to have their kids while they were in their late 20s rather than their late 40s. So she stopped out of the professional life for a couple of years until the kids went to school. But she, because of the structure of legal careers in America, she's now indelibly on the mommy track. And that means she will never have an opportunity to be a really great professional lawyer, despite her own remarkable abilities and despite the huge investment that the country has made in her legal education. That is dumb. That's crazy. And same thing is true, for example, at universities. There's no reason at all why we have to be trapped into this old-fashioned notion that fit when we mainly had one career families that forced people to follow a particular career track. Similarly, much greater flexibility in the work day is now possible. When we all worked on assembly lines and I couldn't say I'm going to do my hubcaps from 6 to 12, but now that we're mostly working with moving information around, it ought to be a lot more possible to do dramatically more flex time, release time, and working at home and so on. Now, people talk a lot about this, but the fact that our rush hours in all major American cities are growing is the best evidence that we are not, despite the talk about flexible time and working at home and so on, we're mostly rushing at the same hour to our offices. And that's, from my point of view, crazy. We've got to be able to think about how we can make our work life, our career life, much more flexible. And people want this. I think this is not a hard sell to the average American. This is a kitchen table issue for most average Americans. It will become one of the most important political issues of the next decade.
Could I just say, the woman who reviewed your book in the New York Times Book Review, Margaret Talbot, I think was the name, made the point that, yes, we've lost a great deal of at-home time, family dinner time, socializing, neighborhood time. But she said the big reason, and she felt you neglected it, was that women like her had become professionals, had found a great deal of satisfaction that had been denied to them before. And she says at the end of that review, it was worth it. It's a good trade for her.
Well, I actually don't agree with the claim that I ignored it. I spend actually more than a more than two chapters on the question of how changes in American work life have affected. I don't know exactly what parts of the book she read or didn't read before she wrote the review, but it certainly is absolutely not true that I deny that there's been important gains, not just to women, but to the whole country from the fact that women are involved in, have greater opportunities to be involved in professional life. My daughter is a professional woman. She's also a mom, and the last thing in the world I'd want is for her to not to give up her professional opportunities. I'm not saying that we should reverse those trends at all. I'm saying, on the contrary, that we have to make our workplace more flexible to allow people to fit together the things that they want to do. I'm not saying that anybody has to take care of their family, but lots of people want to spend more time with their family. They would like to actually to have a chance to do more connecting, as Terry was talking about in his call. And all I'm saying is that's a perfectly legitimate and not sort of anti-professional request to make. We ought to switch the balance of the kind of balance of assumptions here. Is if somebody asks their boss for time off to fit together with their family, take care of their family obligations or their community obligations, we ought not to think that they're somehow less professional for that reason. It's a matter of any more, and it's not a private matter. It's a matter of that we all ought to be concerned about.
Robert Putnam is our guest, and we're finally having it out over this enormously provocative angle on America. His book is called Bowling Alone, the notion that we're still bowling, maybe bowling more than ever, but not in the kinds of deeply affiliated groups that made it the socially rich experience it used to be. His book is subtitled The Collapse and Revival of American Community. This is The Connection on WBUR Boston and PRI. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Bowling Alone Connection with the Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam, who's prepared to grieve over the conclusion that American affiliation, community life, joining is not what it used to be. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, what is your experience of the groups you used to be in, you are in, for politics, for singing, for sewing, for reading, for worship? 1-800-423-8255. Makes the Bowling Alone connection. Sheila Tobias joins us by phone from Tucson, Arizona. She's a political sociologist who's written an article on one of the core groups that we talk about, choruses. Her article was for the Journal of American Culture. Sheila Tobias, what is happening to singing groups in this country as you see it?
Well, it's interesting to listen to Dr. Putnam, whose book I thoroughly enjoyed. I have to tell you, I laughed out loud at some of the statistics, not because they're inherently funny, but because they're archived at all. I mean, who would imagine that anybody keeps track of how many bridge games are played? 500 million a year, and that they're But I did enjoy it, and I don't fundamentally disagree. I'm just doing a micro study of one type of social activity and asking some political questions as well. I'm studying choruses. These are community, non-church-related choruses of adults and children, looking at the numbers, looking at the rate of increase, and it appears from a National Endowment for the Arts study that today, get this, 1 in 10 adult Americans is involved in a regular basis in a singing group that person takes very seriously. I'm also interested in why, this is a political question, such a level of activism, and I call it activism as well as activity, hasn't generated locally or nationally greater support for music in the schools, support for the National Endowment for the Arts, for local symphonies. Why these people seem to go to their meetings, rehearsals, take them extremely seriously, put in a great deal of time, claim when I interview them it's the most meaningful event of their week, and yet not transform this level of energy into something that has a political capital, to use the terms that are being used on this program. So it's a question that I really have in a way for Dr. Putnam to explain at what point a schmoozing group, and in a way, although they're very disciplined and very committed, these are schmoozers to the extent they're machers, and I really appreciate that distinction in the book. They are making music, and they're making music for audiences, and they're making something beautiful happen in their community, but they're not making a political dent on our country's declining funding for music.
Interesting question. Robert Putnam.
Well, I completely agree with Sheila. You won't be surprised at this. As I say in the book, when I turn to the question of ways that we can approach the problem, specifically one of the suggestions that I endorse is the idea that there ought to be a lot more support for arts and cultural activities, especially participatory arts and cultural activities, not only for the reason that Sheila talked about, that is, that it's a good opportunity for people to connect, I agree with that completely, but because distinctively arts and cultural activities provide an occasion or a platform on which you can construct what I call bridging social capital, that is, connections that link us to people unlike us. There are a lot of forms of connection in America, church going, for example, which is really important, but generally speaking, relatively few people go to church with people of a different race or even of a different class. Similarly, most organizations are relatively homogeneous, but art provides an opportunity, as you know yourself, Chris, an opportunity for people to for you to connect with people of different races or different classes or different ethnic backgrounds. And therefore, as I say in the concluding chapter, I think that arts activities are a distinctively important way to encourage building community networks that cross class and race lines. I have to add that it's not just the National Endowment for the Humanities which has come up short in funding these sorts of activities, but nationwide, there was a defunding of extracurricular activities like band and chorus in American high schools during the 70s and 80s, which was completely dumb. We know statistically, we know from lots of studies, that the best predictor of which kids are going to get involved in civic life as adults is who's involved in extracurricular activities in high school, like band and chorus and football and so on. But
Sheila Tobias, you've raised a sort of political question I don't think it's been answered yet, which is to say, if 1 in 10 people are singing and enjoying it in a free non-church choir, why doesn't that suggest a political base for cranking up music in schools and rebuilding symphonies, that sort of thing? My own quick guess is that the 1 in 10 number is awfully high. I mean, you're talking about choruses outside churches. I mean, you were talking barbershop or I don't know exactly what, patriotic. Not 1 in 10 people I know sing in a non-church chorus.
Well,
are you sure of that number?
I know either, but we've got to rely on the kind of quantitative data that Dr. Putnam relies on, and this is really data from a national study. Related to that, about Margaret Talbert's comment that maybe we are reinventing new forms as older ones atrophy, the data shows that the barbershoppers, which you mentioned, are 33,000 strong, mostly in the United States.
That's not 1 in 10.
But static, not growing, and the average age is in the 50s, which would support Professor Putnam's thesis. On the other hand, there are these new choruses you mentioned in the introduction, gay-lesbian choruses, which are enormous, growing all the time, and have something of a political agenda. It's soft politics. It's present gays and lesbians in a context of beauty, of making wonderful sound. I've been told by more than a few that it's a means by which young people who don't have the courage to inform parents and friends that they are gay come out. They actually join a gay or lesbian chorus, then invite their significant others to a performance at which the purpose is really to render these people who are so much like us and so talented more familiar, more normal sources of beauty. So that there are some sort of subtle political agendas at work there. Jewish choruses, I mean, this is in an era where Berkowitz says, you know, Jewish identity is severely at risk through intermarriage, and they are on an increase. There's a Catskill Hills, Catskill Mountains Festival every summer of Jewish courses, 500 or so participants. Gay Lesbians will have a festival this week at which 10,000 singers are coming, representing, you know, tens more. Thousands of non-festival goers, and
we're delegating you, Sheila Tobias, to be there to welcome them and encourage them and build them up to 1 in 10, if that's what's involved. Sheila Tobias, thank you for joining us. 1-800-423-8255. Heather is on the line. Hello, Heather. Are you there, Heather? Try it again. 1-800-423-8255. Marge is on the line.
Hi. Oh,
hello, Marge.
I took some time a few years ago to just sort of revamp my whole life. I have plenty of time to sing. I do recitals. I live in Boston. My son does recitals. He's both. Since he was 14, he's been very active in music. He's on the swimming team. He's volunteered in at least 3 or 4 different organizations since he was about 12, and we're just having a wonderful time creating a nice public life for ourselves. He has a strong interest in politics and how people are doing. However, I haven't spoken to my mother in a year. I am divorced. We homeschool, and that's the only way that we're able to get all of these other extracurricular activities in his life. I went to several Boston Pops concerts last week alone, and noticed that there's sort of a dearth of people around that are like me. I'm a black woman, and I'm just sort of wondering. As many people do like me, who are sort of growing and changing, as I have sort of changed my life from a sort of a fundamentalist Christian person who had plenty of community growing up, and now am sort of becoming far more inclusive, I don't have those original associations anymore. I've got new ones, but I'm sort of, I don't know if I should be worried about the old ones that I don't have.
That's a very interesting personal story, Marge. And don't go away. I mean, this is a sort of microcosmic embodiment of the whole scene. I mean,
yeah.
It involves a change in religious style, age, musical taste.
Yeah, it's true. It does embody these changes. And, you know, there are, I'm sure that Marge would say there are pluses and minuses to the kinds of changes she's been through. And I'm the last thing I want to do is get judgmental here about changes that people make in their own lives. And I have to say in particular that what Marge is doing with her son, getting him involved in volunteering and singing and so on, swimming, I guess, was another one of the things, is terrific, because it is exactly that generation, the generation of her son and you know, my grandchildren, that are the best sign of hope in the future. There is, I think, the single most important favorable sign in American life is that there is a real uptick in volunteering among very young kids in their teens and early 20s, and that's a terrifically good sign. And
what about that? Marge's sense in the net that
we're alone.
She's more isolated.
Yeah. Well, I don't know quite what to say. I think that's typical, actually, of Americans. I don't know, Marge, how you weigh out the pluses and minuses of the fact that you know, when you go to the Pops concert, you don't feel connected to people.
Well, I really do, because we all love this music. I feel connected in that particular way. But I certainly don't have the traditional community that I have, and I think that there would be some criticism of me, say, from other African-Americans. Where are you? Where have you been? You know, we sent you off to school, and where are you when we need you in the community?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a huge issue. And, you know, when I look at going to homoracial churches every week, every 7 days with my child, well, that's a tradition, frankly, that I don't want to pass on.
Right.
It is. And I've learned so much more from many others who are healthy Americans, who are following other walks of life toward God, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm concerned about perpetuating the kind of claustrophobia, the kind of, you know, we're a member of this group, and we're the best, and this is the only way we can, you know, connect. I don't want to perpetuate that in this culture. I don't want to do it. I'll be the one person in the world that doesn't do that anymore.
Well,
Marge, you're fabulous. I mean, you've nailed this problem. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Bowling Alone connection. Can I throw try once more to throw a little spanner in the works here? I know you
sure.
don't want to count internet affiliations as association, and I'm with you on that. But on the other hand, something you see on the street all the time, and I think it's really important, in a time of huge immigration, an immigration trend in this country, tremendous affiliation in the immigrant groups. Every Cambodian knows every Cambodian. Every Irish babysitter is playing cards at a pub in Dorchester with other Irish babysitters on a Friday night. The Brazilians know where the other Brazilians are. And they bring not only sort of examples of family structure, but of political self-interest, economic self-interest, unfortunately not unions. I mean, we're not going to give these people economic power of all things, but in the sense of who they are and who they're connected to, a terrific vitality, it seems to me.
I agree, Chris. My son-in-law is a Hispanic immigrant to the United States, and I'm very aware of the pluses, the great pluses of those immigrant groups. I don't think we ought to romanticize, however, the degree to which people in a new area can also feel isolated. At least I'm judging by my son-in-law's experience, where he found that he was actually definitely not welcomed by some of the existing organizations, religious and other organizations in his community. So
yeah, but he figured it out. Marry a Putnam, and you're launched.
I think that's being a little too flip, Chris. I think he would like to have had more contacts with people from who appreciated his cultural background, and I think he didn't find that. Look, every immigrant group makes a real strong effort to try to maintain social connections within it, and that's terrific. That's wonderful, and I don't disagree with that at all. That's true for every immigrant wave that came to the United States. Can I go back for a second to
Sure.
the internet thing? Because I think inadvertently you might, in speaking quickly about my views about the internet, you might have given the wrong impression. I am not a technophobe at all on the internet. I think that the internet actually has a potential for being an important contributor to making this problem better. The internet had nothing to do with the problem emerging. The trends down and all the graphs of the book begin going down when Bill Gates was in grade school. So the internet had nothing to do with the cause of this problem. The internet has the potential for being a major benefit. The issue really is whether the internet and related technologies are going to end up being a kind of a nifty telephone. That is a way of expanding and deepening and strengthening our ties with other real people. Or whether it'll end up being a nifty TV. That is something that becomes a more or less passive source of entertainment, but not something that links us to other real breathing human beings. And I think the jury is still out on that, actually.
1-800-423-8255, the Bowling Alone connection. Shay is on the line.
Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Shay.
My comment was that I used to be a working professional mom with two young kids, and I decided to stay home partly because I felt like I didn't have the time to make the social connections because I was always too busy working. Now that I've stayed home, I joined a writer's group, and I find that I'm still not connecting with women with children. I'm connecting with women my age who don't have children, or I'm connecting with retired women. So it seems to me that I haven't found yet the social connection network that I can also include my children in.
Yeah, that's a very interesting dilemma, Shea, because it does capture the fact that the society as a whole has changed in ways that make it hard for any individual to solve the problem all by themselves. If the other moms of other kids are all working and they're mostly working 9-to-5 kinds of hours, it's harder for the rest of us to hook up with them. And so one reason why I've written the book is to try to call attention to this collective problem so we all focus a little more on how we can make time for connecting. I mean, I think actually stay-at-home moms with kids are a good example of an area where you could imagine the internet actually being a helpful assistant to this problem. I don't mean you know, surfing the web as an alternative to meeting moms of other young kids, but local community bulletin boards, e-bulletin boards that provide an opportunity to hook up with other people and, you know, make play dates or whatever. So this is, I'm trying to use that as an example of a way in which you can imagine using some of the newer technologies to address some of these, the problem, for example, the problem that Shay mentioned.
Obviously, we're supposed to all pop up off the couch, turn the TV out, get busy on something we love with somebody else. Tell us how to do it. Or tell people who buy the premise but don't know where to turn how to do it. What's the Putnam program here?
Well, there's no single program, Chris. And can I say, just first of all, to underline something you said in the opening remarks, this is not a matter of just warm, cuddly feelings. There are measurable benefits to a community and to our own physical health from social connection. So it's not just a matter of nostalgia for the 50s, which is sometimes people think, well, you know, maybe we've outgrown our need for connections with other people. And I don't think that's true. There is no single Putnam 10-point program for solving this. I think partly it involves changes in public policy. I've indicated one of those. That is, I think there needs to be dramatic, radical change in labor law and labor practice governing our work lives and making it easier for people to fit their work connections together with their family and community connections. It involves partly initiatives that would occur out of the private sector. For example, I think we need to urge, and I'm working with people on both coasts, so people who are in the internet.com world, think of ways to creatively, as I said earlier, to try to make the internet a nifty telephone and not just a nifty television. And I think there's some reason for doing that with public support, because I think most of the dot-com money over the last year or two has been in effect invested into getting bright people to work on making it a nifty TV, making the internet work for Disney rather than work for our communities. I think there are a series of things we can do in our schools that we know would work. We know smaller schools are better for letting kids get opportunities to connect with one another. We know that extracurricular activities work. We know that community service works in the sense that kids who've been exposed to extracurriculars or who've been exposed to community service develop social skills and habits of involvement that stay with them the rest of their lives. I think, as I said before, that we need to, as a community, invest a lot more in arts and cultural activities, not just what you might call art appreciation, but actually doing things with other people, whether that's painting or dancing or singing. I think that there are important ways in which the signs of some early interest in religious revival could be helpful here, and that's not, I'm not saying there ought to be a national, you know, a national a department of religious engagement that gets everybody to go to church. I'm saying I think that this is something that religious leaders and others are in fact working on, how to combine some of the excitement of evangelical religion with some of the open-mindedness of more traditional denominations.
That's not exactly a 10-point list, but it'll do. It's a very interesting set of proposals. I want to say one more call here. Scott is on the line.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
Good, Scott. Thank you.
Good. I'm home on vacation here, and I'm listening to this, and it occurs to me how much Mr. Putnam's missing what real people are doing. And I'll just give you...
So you're home on vacation listening to The Connection.
And washing windows right now, and that's one of my points. when I look at my own group of friends or the demographic group that I'm in, and I'm 42, I look at the four or five things that people are doing with their leisure time, because what really Mr. Putnam's talking about is time management and what do you choose to do with your time when you're not working. And I'll just give you the five things that I think that people are doing that he's not even considering. I think in terms of leisure time, people and the numbers support this. People are spending a lot more time on things like golf and fitness, individual fitness. I had a neighbor of mine who was training for a marathon in Alaska to raise money for leukemia. You know, it took him 4 or 5 hours a day to do that. You go out and golf. That's a 4 or 5 hour effort.
A good walk spoiled, as we say, yeah.
And each of those have small communities in them, especially the fitness and the golf club. I mean, if you belong to a private club or even a public club, there's a couple hundred people you see on a regular basis. Each of those is a community.
We got to get out of here. That's what we call anecdotal, but it's very persuasive to me. Last word, Bob Putnam?
Well, I wish I could match anecdote with anecdote, but I have to say what all of the evidence shows is that Americans are taking part in the aggregate less in sports now than we did a generation ago, and especially less in team sports. I hate to be the grouch.
Play more golf, watch less television, Scott. Keep washing the windows. Thank you for calling. Robert Putnam, thank you for bowling alone, and thank you for joining us on The Connection. Thanks also to Sheila Tobias. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Granitar, offering a comprehensive suite of strategic, technical, and operational services to create Internet solutions that deliver business results. On the web at granitar.com.